talking about when it turns into dog sex.
No, I thought you'll be happy. That's the one that raised this year.
Okay, did you have an assignment due today?
Yeah.
That's what I thought. Why don't you go ahead and turn that in? Oh, wait, you know what I'm going to do? Wait. I'm going to ask you to exchange your assignment this week and then turn it in next week after you've exchanged it. And what I want you to do is exchange your assignments with somebody else and then add to theirs what you think it lacks. And in reading it, you'll also learn some things that yours lacked. And so I want you to just go ahead and exchange it to the one next to you, and then we'll turn them in next week. So exchange your assignment with the person that is next to you. Okay. And that'll be due next week. Let me write that down and make sure. I decided to go ahead and do that because there's a lot of information in here that some is given in the class and the other is personal information, and you could learn a lot from each other by this. And so I want to give at least that opportunity. Today is the 8th. Okay. So that'll be due next week at the 15th. Boy, you're right. Okay, let me get that straight. Okay, I had the wrong days down. Okay, good. All right. Hallelujah.
Yeah.
We're in pulpit, in the section entitled Pulpit Etiquette. Pulpit Etiquette. And said several things now so far. The last one was about racing through your sermon. Don't do it. I gave you several points on that, about emphasis and different things. Next point is put your whole soul into your delivery. Put your whole soul into your delivery. Half-heartedness is fatal. Have you ever tried to jump across a ravine where you knew that you could probably jump it if it were just on flat ground? But it's scary. If you run up to that ravine and if you halt in any way, if you question in any way, if you don't throw yourself fully into it, you're going to plunge to your death. Well, that's about what happens in a sermon. You plunge to your death. And it's a death to die, all right, when you're in front of all those people and half-hearted, trying to give something across. If you're not stirred by the message, they won't be either. They won't be either. If you're not stirred by the message. Sometimes you need to get mad at the devil. Because if you don't, they won't. You need to fall in love with God. Because if you don't, they won't. You know, in that sermon. You need to be accepting the challenge of your own message before they'll be able to accept the challenge of your message. You need to generate a passion for the message and for the people. A desire to see that thing filled out. And then you'll come with an effort and the force of persuasion. You'll try to persuade them and get them to come across to what you're teaching them, telling them, believing that you're saved. Psychologists say that when you communicate, 10% of the people will respond to simply what you say. 70% of the people respond to how it is said. The inspiration of the message. You know, you could take Jimmy Swaggart's messages and read them off to a crowd, and you would hardly stir a soul. You got to have the fire like he's got the fire if you're going to affect the people that you're preaching to. George Whitefield was said to have set the world on fire because he was on fire. Now, sometimes what happens is when you're in your study, fire comes on you and into your message, and you're stirred. Well, when you get in the pulpit, don't throw water on it. You know, out of a fear of being too fanatical or being too expressive or too emotional, we've got to get rid of those demons that have been on our backs trying to shut us down because we're getting too free. Boy, I tell you, I thank God enough for this move. This move is doing that in so many lives, doing that in my life. John Wesley said, put fire in your sermon or put your sermon in the fire. Forget it if you don't put fire into your sermon. Seventy percent respond to inspiration. Does that upset you? You're part of that same statistic. You're part of that same statistic. Somebody will come up to you and say, brother, I think I ought to do this and that and this and that. And you'll think about it and maybe. But then a brother comes and says, brother, you've got to because no. And that inspiration, they didn't tell you anything new. But because they were stirred about it, you did it. That's exactly how advertisement goes. If they had a dead, dry advertisement, buy Wheaties. That wouldn't do near the same as all that music, da-da-da, and all this, and the funny, and catch your eye on it, and put something neat about it so that it kind of clicks in your mind, and you're kind of accepting of it. It'll stir you to action, whereas the other would not. Next point. Remember your place as a pastor, if you are one when you're preaching. What is your place? And even as a preacher, you have the same place, and that is you are there to serve them, not to overlord them. You're there to serve them. You do not serve them if you do not strike that thing deep into their heart. That is not a service to them. You do them a disservice. They need to be compelled to follow it. So we do not overlord, but we serve. Next point. Be accurate. Be accurate. And be clear and distinct in your speaking. And be forceful. Be forceful. Now let me talk for just a moment about your voice. Have you ever heard somebody that kind of got in a speaking tone of voice? And they were trying to force the anointing, kind of, and they kind of were straining their voice and just continued. I've done that myself. You wear yourself out by the end of the message, and you realize, boy, I punched this whole thing through with self. you hear somebody straining, trying to sound anointed. You know what I mean? And they're straining at it, and it's on the same level. Maybe they are anointed, but their voice is at a strain. It wears you out after a while. It wears you out. It's tiring to the listener because it basically gives a high emphasis to everything that's said. And that tends to take away the emphasis. It's like a pastor that's constantly calling his people to do some radical action. But it doesn't matter how important the issue is, he's calling them to radical action on everything. After a while, you wear out your congregation. You wear them out. Everything is just as important. Well, see, in a sermon, you can make the same mistake. And now turn to Jeremiah 11. I mean, you put just as much emphasis on turning to Jeremiah 11 as, you know, as everything else that you're saying. And it wears out the congregation. But you want to speak loud enough and clear enough that they don't have to strain to hear you. That can also wear out the listeners. It's tiring. In this, you also need to learn how to use the microphone. And there's some that you can get kind of in a trap that for every emphasis they make, they want to lean into the microphone so it gets louder. That can become tiring. If there's anything, one thing that you do too much that kind of draws attention to itself, it becomes tiring. But speak clear enough. If you raise your voice really loud, you may want to step back from the microphone just a little bit. Or it can hurt their ears. If you're lowering your voice for emphasis, you're lowering your voice. Then is the time to sometimes step right up to the mic. And that will also add emphasis, so the mic will pick it up. The variation of a sermon in the voice intensity and the level and the rate of speech and the forcefulness is what gives it interest. It's the variation. It's much like a restful scene or an interesting scenery. It's the variation of it that creates the interest of it. You know, you've got the lake and then you've got the mountain and then you've got this. Whereas if you took a picture of just that water, because there's not that much variation, it's all the same. If everything is exactly the same, there's not much interest in it. It would be like if you had for a painting on the wall, which in our modern day art, which isn't art, it's slop. It's in a modern day slop. They might just have a piece of paper with a bunch of exact same shape, size, and color dots. So you got a polka dotted thing, and that's the picture on the wall. You know, and that's it. The variation is that there's a border, you know, and that there then it's put inside a frame. It's variation that creates so much interest. And you see the variation of that scenery, it causes it to be restful. As you look at the wooded hillside, the variation of the different colors, especially in the fall, with the different colors of the fall, that variation creates interest. Next point. There are some things that you can do that can be very effective for emphasis. But if overdone, they become tiresome. Whatever you use for emphasis must be used in moderation and at the appropriate time. And you need to, of course, have common sense. For instance, in John 21, verse 15, let's talk about using a low voice for emphasis. John 21, verse 15. So when they had dined, Jesus saith to Simon Peter, Simon, son of Jonas, lovest thou me more than these? Now that would be a good example of where a low voice would bring emphasis. When he had dined, Jesus saith to Simon Peter, Simon, son of Jonas, lovest thou me more than these? It's a time of meditation, of thought, of contemplation. This is a deep question. This would be a lousy example of something loud for emphasis. When he had dined, Jesus saith to Simon Peter, Simon, son of Jonas, lovest thou me more than these? It totally distorts what is being done. It takes away the contemplation and the carefulness in which that is brought through. It's piercing into the heart. And so it's a time of quietude. Like the scripture talks about, you're on your bed meditating because it's a time of quiet. So here's something you want them to meditate on. So that would be something that you would say with a low voice. Now, you wouldn't want to use a low voice here in Matthew chapter 3, verses 7 and 8. But when John the Baptist saw many of the Pharisees and Sadducees come to his baptism, he saith unto them, O generation of vipers, who hath warned you to flee from the wrath to come? So that'd be a bad example. There you would want to use a loud voice, you know, because he would have been shouting. He would have been speaking loudly to them. And so there's a time for emphasis is a low voice. But you'll use that low voice when you're wanting a contemplation, something to be carefully considered, to be meditated on. It kind of puts them into a smooth mood of consideration. Now, a loud voice. Let me give you a good example of where a loud voice would be good. Matthew 27, verse 46. In about the ninth hour, Jesus cried with a loud voice, saying, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani. That is to say, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? See, there you'd want to use a loud voice. And emphasize it. My God, my God. And it'd be loud because it's calling. And of course, it even says he said it with a loud voice. But a bad example would be the very next verse. Some of them that stood there when they heard that said, this man calls for Elias. Some that stood by and heard that would not say, this man calls for Elias. They wouldn't have said that because that'd be a bad example of using a loud voice. There again would be, this man calls for Elias. Elijah. Again, a contemplation. Your humor and your satire also have to be used with appropriate, careful, moderate use. Let your moderation be known unto all men. Philippians 4, verse, what is it? 2, I think. Philippians 4, 2. And let your moderation be known unto all men. Our pastor is really good often about putting in some humorous actions and responses on the pulpit at just the right time. And that really add an emphasis. One time, he was talking about how you don't respond. He was preaching on legalism. And we've had so much legalism in our church. And he was giving an example about how you are going to manifest love when you just experience the Lord. And he said, you're not going to do this. And he mimicked getting filled with the Holy Ghost and then just all of a sudden clamming up and just walking off the platform. And if you remember when he did this, it was about a little over a year ago. He walked off the platform, walked down onto the floor, walked out the door, opened the door, and let it shut. And he was outside. And it really emphasized the point, you know. I mean, it just shut out. I mean, boom, he's gone. Nothing there. It was so cute. And it took him a little while to do it. So, I mean, that's quite a little trek. All the way off the platform and out the door by the usher stand and let the door close. And he came back in, and here he is, the preacher. But it really gave the idea of how, you know, you're not going to just shut things out when you have an experience like that in God. Got him. I've had that thing hanging on me all morning. Finally got it out. Feels so good. One time, and I still remember it, he kicked the devil. You know, there's a time, now if you overplay that, if every time you talk about the devil you kicked, it'd just totally lose it. But there have been a couple of times, you know, just that action and how you're to respond to Satan, and it was used in a reverent way, in a responsible way, and it had a proper attitude on it in the scripture. It wasn't just a mockery. But when he did that, it added so much power to the point he was making, you'll never forget it. Remember preaching on the ego Christians? I remember just this last weekend. I remember being impressed by that, just the different actions and the statements he makes and, you know, the way he walks, or, well, I'm not going to do this or that, and then sit over and sit down on the podium, or sit down, excuse me, back on the music ministry stand or something, you know, and cross his arms and act a certain way. And living that out and carrying that out can provide such a wonderful emphasis. But if he did that every time he said that, it would ruin it. It would spoil it. See, it has to be spontaneous. But if it's done in moderation, it really can add an emphasis. So, in the area of humor. Gesturing and acting the thing out. Is again, can be a marvelous thing. It can be a very teaching thing. Actually, it kind of ties into what I last just shared with you. And that is to use your body to live out what happened. There's one brother that I knew did it badly, fairly badly. He was in another church, and we worked together, but he liked illustrative sermons, he called them. And so he just did a lot of acting. And it was, you know, it kind of catched the interest of the people. But see, that gets really old after a while. It gets really old after a while. And then you can kind of, if the people are knowing how you're going to act the next time, and they're expecting it always, and you always do the same thing, and whenever this particular part comes up, you do the same thing, because it was real cutesy the first time you did it, and so you always do it, that gets really old. And so you basically just want to state things, just teaching clarity, but at times for punctuation. You may want to act a thing out. And you don't want to fall, therefore, to this feeding on human applause and feeding on human favor, because the first time you did it, there was a tremendous response. Now you do it all ever since. Never you come to that particular thing, you do it ever since. I preached on, what did I preach on? Legalism. Was that time? When I stomped out legalism? Remember that? Stomp. And because it was natural, it was normal. That was the thing I had to do. But if I do it every time now, since then, it wears it out and takes away the emphasis. It spoils it. And so you have to just keep adapting, keep letting things come spontaneously. If you try to think them all out, it won't, you know, you'll usually muff it. If it comes spontaneously, then it'll fit better. And how is it going to come spontaneously? If you are free. If you get loosened up so that you're not inhibited by what people are going to think, but your whole emphasis of your heart and life is to get this across. I want to indelibly put this on their mind. And so you're thinking, what can I do? I just want, in your emphasis of your mind, I want them to remember this. I want them to know this. And so there's that thought. And you're not so concerned about what they think about you. You're concerned about what they think about the message. You're concerned how they receive the truth. And so you're basically just, you know, talk in a normal way. But for emphasis, these are the things, types of things that you would do. Pounding the pulpit. You know, pounding the pulpit can really have a good emphasis at the right time. Or using the pulpit. You know, I stand at the door and I knock. And especially if you're teaching on the difference between that word knock and another word knock, in Matthew 7, when Jesus taught about the Lord's Prayer, he that knocks, it shall be opened. And that knock is it's unceremonious pounding. For he that knocketh, it shall be opened unto him. In other words, he that doesn't give up. You know? Whereas, I stand at the door and knock, it's a polite rap. And see, to play that out, using the pulpit like that can be really beneficial. Or pounding the pulpit, you know? Like, Lord! See, it's an emphasis, and you use it because, and it's a natural thing. God, open to me, you know. He crashed the pulpit. One time I remember using the pulpit. Boy, what was it? I think it was in a Bible college class. And it was Jesus cleansing the temple. And I don't know, I was really into it that day. And he took the tables of the money changers. I crashed the pulpit. And it just played out to you. Did you realize, yeah, boy, he really did, didn't he? He took the tables of the money changers and he turned them over. So it doesn't have the same impact. And he grabbed them and he threw them to the ground, you know, and you take your boy. You can use this thing, if you use it right. But if you do that every time you talk about it, see, then it loses its impact, loses its emphasis. Pounding the pulpit. Lord, Lord, open unto us. The five foolish virgins. Lord, Lord. And so you can pound on your pulpit. But it has to be properly done. When Jesus said, let the little children come unto me, that wouldn't be a good time to pound the pulpit. Let the little children come unto me. See? Because it wasn't that way. You know. See, there's an overkill. It's an overemphasis. And so it's got to fit with the mood of what you're saying. And the best things, of course, is freedom. That's the best thing. That's the biggest thing. Have you noticed how there's been kind of an emphasis on that in this class so far? This is the biggest thing, is that cultivating that freedom so that you express it the way you would express it. Now, see, this strikes terror in the heart of some. That's because they're so bound. They're so concerned about what others think about themselves. God wants you to get loose from that so that you can just express what you are inside, how you feel inside. And you're not going to be concerned about what other people think. And if you never get beyond that, I promise you'll never be a Whitfield. You'll never fulfill. You'll never be a persuader. You can't be a persuader if you don't get beyond that. It's the same difference between the non-spirit-filled. You'll become like a non-spirit-filled preacher who just doesn't have the power. Being filled with the Holy Ghost just gives a person so much freedom that you don't have otherwise. And let me also say, in having spiritual unions and moving in the Spirit, because I have tried to have freedom, and I've had a measure of freedom, but boy, I tell you what, God has done this last year, just breaking up things inside, so that it's just taking away a concern and a care about a lot of other things for my life. And I feel that I see that also in Pastor. There is a freedom and a release. And it doesn't mean that everything is totally different now, but what is being built inside is going to one day then be able to spill over in people that are lost in the will of God and care not about other things. That's all they can care about is the will of God. Okay, the next point about pulpit etiquette is how you dress. The main point, and this is the main point, and all the rest of it is sub-points, is dress conservatively. Conservatively. And conservatively basically means up to date, but not faddish. Also not dowdy or slovenly because of, you know, old styles. And in this, I don't know if you're like me, but I don't particularly like to shop. And I'm afraid I don't care as much as I should about how I look. And so what I have to do is I have to ask my daughters and my wife. Now, luckily I've got, some that are pretty, kind of careful and in my wife and so forth. And then and sometimes I've asked brothers. Beginning of this year, I pulled out some suits and I had a brother come over and look at them. He looked at one and he said, and it was one that I just love. I love that suit. I just love the way it fits. I love the way it feels and everything. But it's, I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's out of style or what. Old looking pants or something. I don't know what it is. He gave a few points on it. Because I like the way some things look on me, but they don't look good, I guess. You know what I mean? And so you might have to have somebody else, like I do. You might have to have somebody else. Others maybe are more up to date with what fashions are looking like. Because you don't want to look weird. You don't want to look like you're living in the '60s still. You don't want to look like. See, you want to be up to date, but conservative. There are some preachers that really are ostentatious. They wear what we call loud suits. They're loud. They draw attention to the wrong thing. They're loud suits. They're either bright blue or perfectly white they're on the extremes of the fashion. And they wear loads of jewelry. They got all this stuff flashing in the air. They wear these garish neckties. Those things all detract. Remember how we talked about how you don't want to have any habits that are detracting during your sermon? Well, what you wear can be a detraction. And so the person will be affected by what you're wearing the whole time, and it's a distraction. And it detracts from the sermon. It hurts your image. Because those things, who wears those things? Who wears those things? It's not the conservative. See? But, do you know what? Everybody accepts the conservative. In fact, in Malloy's Dress for Success, in Malloy's research, they found out that even people that were very faddish, hippie, worldly mod, they even had more trust in people that were conservative than themselves, than in people that were in their same place. Because they would ask questions like, Who would you trust more to sell you a car? They put up all these pictures. And again, even the people that were very liberal and very faddish and mod and long-haired and that, they would choose men that had shorter hair than themselves. There'd be a picture of somebody that had the same length of hair that they had, and one that had shorter hair, they'd choose one that had shorter hair. They'd choose the one that was more conservative. Again and again, they'd choose the one that was more conservative. And so that image is the safe, right, proper image to bear. And that's how we all, that's generally how we're made up. Because what is it that caused people to be faddish, to be, to put themselves in an unusual, to draw attention to themselves? What is it that causes people to draw attention to themselves? It's a carnal thing. And even the world recognizes the carnality of it. And they see the error of it, and they won't trust that person as much as that's carnal. They'll trust a person more that is godly, you know, that has a more conservative manner of life. And how you look and how you dress is a declaration of what's inside. There was one time that Dave Wilkerson was rebuked by a teenager because he was dressing kind of loud and kind of mod like the kids on the street were. And the teenager came up to him and says, "I can't hear what you're saying. Your clothes are talking too loud." And he was just dressing like they were. Trying to, this is what he says about himself. Trying to associate, you know, trying to identify. They didn't like it. And because what is it in you that's making you do that? Some say, "Well, I'm covered with clothes. What's the difference?" Say, "I'm covered with clothes. What's the difference?" That's like eating a salad with chocolate syrup on it, you know. What's the difference? It's all food. Ketchup on ice cream. You are judged by what you got on. And some things don't match. If you've got a message that's life-giving, that is earth-shaking, that is of an eternal consequence, but you're dressed carnally, you're acting and talking in a carnal manner, it just detracts from your message, and it's a contradiction. It's a dichotomy coming out to them that's confusing. To be dressed improperly, of course, therefore, is to bring a confusion to those that you are speaking to. Be slow to adopt new trends. Be slow to adopt new trends. The safest place to buy is in men's shop, conservative men's shop. That's the safest place to buy. It's not the safest place out there, you know, where the latest fads and fancies are, you know, foisted out there. You want to be careful of that. And so wear conservative. The underlying principle, though, of everything else in your dress is to be clean and neat. Clean and neat. Clean bodies, clean hair, clean clothing, so that you don't have, you're not having body odor. You want to have clean breath and using deodorant and so forth. Aftershave is up to you whether you want to or not. Cologne and aftershave. Shop wisely. You'll find that if you shop at the better stores and wait for sales, you'll sometimes get better clothing and better quality clothing. And, you know, and there, of course, there are some outlets that are also good to keep your eyes on. Some that do better than others. My brother was just telling me, and I don't know if it's true or not, but I was told by one person, and this guy always dresses super sharp. But he also dresses conservatively, and he dresses for a smaller budget. And he says he's found one of the better places is Penny's, because they'll bring in some of their stuff is good brand, and they'll have sales there, and he'll find the same brand name suit for $100, $200 less than down at the Bond. Now, I never knew that. And so one of these days I'm going to head down to Penny's and check it out and see. But generally, Penny's to me is always, you know, it seemed like faddish clothes somewhat, but I've hardly shopped at Penny's, so, you know, maybe it's a Kmart that feels that way. I don't know, you know. I'm not sure. Some of those stores are not worth buying at, but others could do real well. I noticed that, what do they call it? It's down there in the drug pavilion.
Rack.
Well, there's the Rack, Nordstrom's Rack. That's another place. Yeah, he mentioned that place, too. There's also a place down there that I walked into, Marshall's, I think it is. And they've got brand name shirts. I mean, some really good name shirts for $10, dress shirts. You know, and so you, if you look, you're careful, you can, for not a lot of money, dress really nice. Then, of course, now this is my Value Village special. It's a really nice suit. It's Nordstrom. Yeah, it's a nice suit. It's borderline on the style, you know. Where it's borderline, I guess. At least that's what they tell me. I don't know. I wear it because I like it. It wrinkles up fast. I'm sure that's probably why it ended up in there. But pardon?
Is it about 10 years old?
I'm sure. I've had it for... Because of the width of the collar? Yeah. So, you know, I'm tagged. I wear a 10-year-old suit. And there's certain size width collars that is pretty much, they just stay, they go a little wider, a little smaller, a little wider, a little smaller, but they stay just about the same. Whereas a fast, they go way big and then way small, way big and then way small. But the basic style has stayed the same for decades and decades and decades. And so if you stay in the conservative line, you're pretty good, pretty close. Same thing with ties. 3 1/4 inches is the right width. I've got the perfect measurement from this digit to this digit, 3 1/4. This one is exactly 3. This is 3 inches at the bottom. So they're a little bit narrower right now. But if you don't go to the 1.5-inch, you know, instead of going really small and then later when they're really big, you know, just stay 3 1/4 is supposedly the size that is stuck, you know, and has been the conservative size. Anyway, your hair. Make sure your hair is neat and so forth. And, of course, your collar and your ears uncovered as far as the length. The colors of your suits in the clothing you wear. Blues and grays are the easiest to coordinate. And they're the conservative colors, blues and grays. Tan can also be good. Avoid green. Green is a color that in suits and in shirts and other things that definitely tears down your credibility. And so stay away from green. Bright reds also can have a negative effect, especially like a red shirt. Now I'm talking about with a suit, you know, other red shirts or whatever, like a sweater like our brother's got here is just fine, but as far as with a suit, to have a suit and then a red shirt. And there's some of the more faddish shirts that have a lot of different contrasting colors that some of them aren't as good either. They don't speak of conservatism. And even the materials. Some materials are almost effeminate, and they look that way. They appear that way. Your basic best is a 65-35 polyester cotton. I mean, that has been a standard for years, and it's a real easily cared for. And, of course, there are others that are good, too. But there are some like the Kiana polyester. It's real soft. A lot of women's dresses are made with it and blouses. And it's also in some men's shirts. And some can look better, but, see, when you get into that type of look, yeah, there's a little look there. It's almost an effeminate type look. You want to be careful. As far as in suits, you know, I'm just saying a couple of things here. Wool is of course the top of the line, but it depends on the type of wool and the weaving of the wool. Often for an all-around suit, the wool polyester blend is the best as far as for care and for wearability and comfort and all of that. Don would like to have everybody that comes to Bible College wear a suit and tie, you know, a shirt and tie, I should say, and either you know, either a suit or a sport coat or a sweater or something. But, you know, a lot of people are uncomfortable in it. And, you know, it's just, it looks sharp, it looks nice, it makes you feel good. If you have a job where you wear it all the time, some people get to where they don't like to be without it. There's a certain image that you portray. All of that is good, but it's too hard to keep up on that, so we haven't established that in Bible college. There are many Bible colleges that do require that. All the men have to wear. Like Jimmy Swaggart, he requires that all the men have to wear a tie, and I believe either a sweater or a jacket. Your color scheme, be careful of that. Again, we were talking about the blues and the grays. As far as a shirt, white is always right, and white is generally the most conservative color and the most accepted color, just a white shirt. Light blue is okay. Beige is okay. But it's white, light blue, and beige. Those are generally the three that fit the best. And if you're wearing it with a suit and you have a striped shirt, the stripes should be, subtle. The stripes should be subtle. shouldn't be loud like what you've got there. Those stripes are good. And, you know, they got real broad stripes, you know, things like that. And there's another one. Those stripes are, you know, good, conservative. Neckties. Again, you don't want something that is speaking so loudly you can't see everything else. You want something distracting. Conservative look is either the solid colors or narrow stripes or small figures on them. And a tie can really do a lot for how you look. A tie really says. In fact, and Malloy said he judges people by their ties. He judges people by their ties. And when I read that, I wondered about that. And I went home and looked at my ties. And that book, Dress for Success, if you haven't read it, I suggest you all read it. Buy it and read it. How many have not read that book? Really? You should all read that book. And take it conservatively, you know. Don't just dump your whole wardrobe and go out and buy everything new. But Dress for Success by Malloy. He's written several books since that time also, but that's his main stay. Yes, sir? Yes.
I heard it's best not to wear striped ties on striped shirts.
Yeah, if you've got things that clash. Like if you have a striped shirt, wear a solid tie. Or figures, small figures. Right. Because the stripes will kind of clash. Good. There's a lot, of course, I'm not saying, and a lot that you can get from the book. Just to mention about the coat, there's a lot of suit coats that really don't fit. That's why there's tailors. That's what tailors are for. And every one of us are a little bit different in the shoulders. The slope of our shoulders, the set of our back, and there can be a lot of wrinkles that are there just because it's not fit right. And boy, it just doesn't look good when it's not fit right. And so it's good if you can get them on sale at a place like Nordstrom or Bond, where they just, for free, they can adjust everything for you along with the suit, the buying of the suit. That's good if you can do that. The bottom of your coat should rest in your cupped fingers. You cup your fingers. Should rest right in the bottom, right there at your knuckles. And your trousers, again, should be comfortable in the waist and should be comfortable standing and sitting. They shouldn't be so tight. And they shouldn't be loose and sloppy. They generally, the bottom of your pants should touch the top of your shoe. Slightly longer at the heel if possible. And it can put a break, and that seems to change with time, whether the crease down the front breaks when it hits the shoe or not. And different ones take different stands on that. It seems to be more often now that there should be a break. That is, that the trouser touched the front of the shoe enough so that it breaks the crease in the front of the leg. As far as shoes, again, proper fit and comfort. Good shoes are important. I talked to one brother that is very wise in clothing and in judging people, and he says, if you want to know where a person is financially and their general status of life, check their shoes. More than anything else, check their shoes. Because their shoes will declare oftentimes where they are. Now, who knows how true? Obviously, there are exceptions to that, but always make sure they're shined. There's a brother that came to me once, and he never forgot this, but at his wedding, his minister, and I thank God it wasn't me, had not shined his shoes, and they were all scuffed up at his wedding. And that really offended him. I mean, it really offended him. Years later, this thing was still kind of a hard one on him. You know, and the brother, you know, he should be beyond your minister having scuffed up shoes, but a word to the wise is sufficient. Don't give him opportunity to be stumbled. Shoes really do have a large part to play. Make sure your socks match. Generally, they should match the shoes in color, generally. That's a general rule. And you don't want to have black shoes and white socks, you know, that type of thing. And so just a couple of comments along that. Are there any questions on dressing? That is part of when you minister, when you preach, that is one of the things that we'll check off, how you look. And so come dressed with this in mind, conservatively, with the, you know, the basic colors of shirt and so forth. And whether you wear a sport jacket or whether you wear a suit, doesn't matter, but just have a jacket and look neat, be neat, have things neat looking, your shoes shine, that sort of thing. And that'll also be part of the things that we'll be checking off. Yes?
I wanted to make a comment about the lapels. They're supposed to be the same width as the tie. Like you said, 3 1/4, like between 3 1/4, 3 1/2. It never changes it more than a quarter, a year, the maximum. It's supposed to be the same size as the lapel. And that's what, when you look at somebody, it just doesn't look funny, it's because his lapel is the size of the tie down the widest part. And also, you can have the lapels taken in, and it costs about $35. I mean, that's about cheap to get that. But they can take them in, and you can restructure a whole suit. You know, 10 years ago, they were wide, and they can probably.
So there's salvation for this thing, huh?
There's a good tailor in Durian that I've gotten to. I went to this jacket instead of Continental Tailor.
Oh, yeah, Continental Tailor, and they do it. I know there's a brother in the church, too, that does it. A brother from Ethiopia, Johannes.
I think Hartman does definitely the best job. That guy, I can't remember.
Hartman's.
He does
a good
job.
The accent.
Yeah, but he's awful expensive,
too. Who is it? Hartman's?
Yeah, I can't remember. He's got a big guy. He's got three stores, too, so I think he might get it done by somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
But he was talking good.
Okay.
I know a real good tailor downtown is Keith. When I used to work down at the market, there's this old Italian guy named Mario. Mario's Custom Tailors.
Mario's Custom Tailors.
Yeah.
He's a good tailor, and he's cheap, and he's downtown.
It's like going to visit your grandpa. He's real personable.
Where is he located?
Right up at the top of TJ's Men's Shop. It's part of the store.
Part of TJ's Men's Shop? Where's that on? Is that on Mike Pike there?
Pike.
First and Pike?
Right across where Candy's used to be.
Okay. Okay, good. Thank you. All right. Next point. Now that we got you all dressed up right. And there's a whole lot more that could be said on that subject, you know, really a whole lot more. We're just going on. The next point is avoid generalities. Avoid generalities. You ever had somebody give a testimony and they sat down and you wondered what they said? And sometimes it's because they were so general. And possibly you've even heard people that are saying that. They say, I know I'm being general, I can't be specific, but this and that and this and that, and you're still not getting it. It's just too general. Effective speaking, that's one of the areas that they cover in effective speaking, is trying to get you and I to speak specifically so that people have something in their mind they can relate to. Now, it's okay to begin a topic with a generalism if you follow with specific points. For example, you might say, God did a deep work in my heart. That's a generalism. If you follow that with specific points, it's okay and it's acceptable. But if you leave it, God did a real deep work in my heart. And then you go on to something else. And you know what else God did? What does that tell you? It didn't tell you anything. It was confusing. In fact, oftentimes things like that are frustrating. If you are a good communicator yourself, and you want to draw clear conclusions from what a person says, that type of communication is frustrating because you don't have anything clear, nothing concrete. It has been said, quote, all general statements are false because they're too broad to apply to all situations or persons. End of quote. They're too broad to apply. They just don't apply. They just don't fit. And that, of course, is a general statement itself. Now, generalities. This can also be done by cliches. You want to avoid cliches. A cliche is a phrase or a statement that becomes an offhand statement used by people in a certain group or crowd. You've heard of possibly the, what do they call them, the Airheads, the girls down in the Valley Girls. Somebody told me about those the other day. You know, they have their cliches. Well, we've got chapelisms. We do. There's phrases that we use at the chapel that are cliches, and they're not definitive. Move in, enter in, step out, pray through, in a new place, put it on the shelf. See, a lot of people don't understand what you're saying. Put it on the shelf. And we'll understand, generally, it's the tenor of the service. The bottom line, of course, that's a little bit more obvious. Some are chaplains and some are not. What has happened is that these things get so used and overused that it strips them of their meaning and it strips them of their power, and they end up being sort of fillers. Or a statement that you attach on to the end of a phrase can be also the same type of thing, sort of a filler. If you know what I mean, if you know what I mean, if you know what I mean. Or you know, or it's just like. Phrases that are repeated over and over, they become fillers, they become detractors from what you're trying to say. Because they're so overused, they don't have their meaning anymore. Along with this, generalities is the idea of abstracts. Abstracts can be so general that, again, they lose the power in what you're trying to say. I don't know how many of you watch Jimmy Swaggart or listen to Jimmy Swaggart very much, but the brother is specific. He speaks specific, speaks clear, gets to the point. Because of that, he's able to reach a lot of people. God has really used that brother. A lot of souls being saved in his ministry. The last 2 years of ministry, there were about 1 million that were won to the Lord. Half a million. Half a million in the last 2 years won to the Lord. That's really wonderful. Plus, a lot of people are being impacted and affected, and the saints are being ministered to. Abstracts. Let's talk about those in just a moment. Seriously, in our society and throughout the world, basically, people are not deep thinkers, philosophizers. It takes training to get to that. We tend to deal with just the concrete, specific items that confront us day to day and how they relate specifically to us. And so that's how you should preach, because you want to preach to the people. Notice the Bible was not written in Attic Greek, which is the universal language. The Attic Greek was written in Koine Greek, which was a street language. And that wasn't used by the professionals. That was used by the people on the street. That was used by the common folk. That's what the Bible was written in. Clear, specific. You need to paint pictures in people's minds. Avoid abstracts because they need pictures. They need concrete things. They need to be able to see. I don't know if you've read the Little House on the Prairie series. Our kids, we bought them and our kids read through them and we read them to them and they were really enjoyable. And you know what I'm sure part of the success is for her? Laura Wilder, whatever her name was, isn't that it? Laura Ingalls Wilder, isn't that the one who wrote them? Part of the success for her, I am sure, is because she became eyes to her sister who was blinded when she was younger. And so this is the oldest sister. She got rheumatism, I think it was. And she scarlet fever. And she lost her sight. And her younger sister, who was Laura, would be eyes for her. And she would describe the sunset. She would describe what she was seeing. And she would walk with her and be her eyes. And I'm sure that that practice is what has enabled her to write such flowing and descript stories. They're just beautiful. You read through them. She'll describe a meal, and by the time she's done, you're just ready to sit down to eat. She'll describe what the house looked like, and you can see it. She'll describe what the prairie looked like, and you've got a perfect picture in your mind. You know exactly what it looks like. And you can just watch what she's doing, because she's learned to do that. We need to learn the same thing. Learn to describe so that people see what you're saying. And seriously, with a girlfriend or your wife or somebody, tell them your interest in doing this. And begin to practice. And just stop and try to be definitive. And definitive in your conversation so that it's clear as to what you're saying. And you can train yourself to be descriptive. You can. And learn to paint pictures. And the world needs it. Okay.